You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 467. There are no rules in filmmaking. Frank Capra.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's film, B-I-Z, book.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. So guys, today on the show, we have Ben Sharrock, who is the writer-director of the new film Limbo. Now, Ben is an award-winning writer-director known for his unique style and cinematic voice. His work is visually striking, quirky, and intelligent. And I wanted to have him on the show not just to talk about his amazing new film, Limbo, where he shines a satirical light on refugees seeking asylum in a remote Scottish island, but we also discuss his origins as a commercial director, how that prepared him to work in feature films, and how he was able to get the money together, how he got a project like this together, which is not an easy sell for a studio or for financiers. So I was really interested to see how he got that done. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Ben Sharrock. I'd like to welcome to the show Ben Sharrock. Man, how you doing, Ben?
Yeah, good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, my friend. I'm good. You are coming to us from the other side of the pond, as I always like to say, in Edinburgh.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Nice and rainy and miserable here at the moment.
And here in LA, it's perfect, as it always is. But we have wildfires, earthquakes. So it balances out in the nature.
Yeah,
and we've got our stuff. We've got our stuff.
Yeah, we just get a bit of light drizzle.
Yes, exactly. You get a little God spitting on you is basically what it is. Just a little bit, not too much. But man, listen, thank you for being on the show. We wanted to bring you on to talk about your new film, Limbo. But I also want to kind of dive into how you got started in your journey as a filmmaker. So how did you get into the business?
I took a sort of interesting route in, which is a little bit related to how I ended up making Limbo as well. But I basically started off with a degree in Arabic and politics. And then in my final year of that, I started specializing in Middle Eastern cinema. And that was really when I kind of made the decision that I wanted to be a film director. And, you know, I think it would also, you know, I should probably say that kind of when I was growing up as a teenager, I did a lot of theater, youth theater, and I actually grew up wanting to be an actor. And then that's kind of like disappeared as I went to university. But then, yeah, when I kind of started discovering all of these kind of, amazing Middle Eastern Iranian films, it just kind of changed my idea of what cinema could be. So I decided to go to film school, made my kind of first short film directly after like my final year exams. I managed to get in. And then I basically spent a year at film school. After that, I got a job in Dubai working in advertising on the agency side. And then I was in Dubai for a year. I knew that I wanted to make films. I wanted to make feature films. I didn't want to be a commercials director. So I ended up getting a scholarship to come back to Scotland and do a Master of Fine Arts. And then basically directly after that, I made my kind of first, my debut feature film, which was, low budget, very low budget, pretty much zero budget, self-funded film, which was made entirely in the Basque language, which is from the Basque country in the north of Spain.
Sure.
And then basically that film it premiered at San Sebastian Film Festival and then just kind of went on this big journey. And I ended up, kind of traveling around the world on the festival circuit, and it, did pretty well. And then that kind of launched me into the getting the funding to write the screenplay for Limbo.
Now, I have to ask you, because I have friends from Dubai. Is it true that it is hotter than literally hell there? Like your shoes will melt?
It is. It's so hot. But it's the weirdest thing about Dubai is how hot it is at night.
Yeah, that's what they're telling me. It's like obscene. Yeah. It's obscene. It's like 95.
Yeah, it's so weird. And it really is like an oven. It's like that's the feeling. It's like a kind of like a fan oven. It's the night heat though. I've never experienced that, and where it's so hot at night. Just it doesn't even make sense to me.
How the hell did a city build up around that? We've built cities here in like Phoenix, which is obscenely hot. We're like 100, 110, and even LA, there's parts of LA that gets to 100, 110 in heat waves. But you guys are consistent in Dubai. Like it was like a consistent like 115, 120 in the day.
Yeah.
Like your shoes melt.
Yeah, yeah.
Like your sneakers melt. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you can't go out during the day. I mean, you know, it's like you're literally like you have to go from your air conditioned building into car into another air conditioned building, and that's how you live. So you can't really spend any time outside during the day at all. But then at night it's really hot as well.
There's just no rest yeah. at all. And yeah. I'm coming from Scotland, I'm assuming it's a bit different. Weather.
Exactly. So I'm just not built for that at all. So that's the real reason that we left Dubai. It wasn't like, because I wanted to get out of here,
man. This is too damn hot. I also come from a commercial background, doing commercials and got my first start there. How did working in commercials prepare you to direct your first feature? I always like asking commercial directors that, because every commercial director has a different angle on that.
That's a good question. I mean, I think the main thing for me really, because I think just dealing with clients and kind of managing the set and kind of, because I guess on set you've got, because I was, when I started directing commercials, I've got, it's like the agency side and then the client as well. And it's like, I think just managing all of those different people and kind of, looking after them, that was probably at that stage for me,
right.
Kind of going from film school into commercials, which was kind of then like, that experiencing a professional set and having people to sort of respond to and look after, like, outside of a student film context was right. Probably the biggest kind of learning curve for me. But actually, in terms of like my kind of style as a filmmaker, I never really got like the chance to do a commercial in the sense that I could really kind of explore my style as a filmmaker. It was almost like too separate from my kind of feature film making.
Now,
unfortunately,
exactly. Look, I know commercial worlds usually you got to deal with the clients and all that stuff. And the one thing that I think commercial worlds does so well is it teaches you the politics of a film, not only the film set, but just dealing with personalities and power and, you know, the hierarchy and stuff like that. Whereas most film directors who go right into features, they don't get that. Like a commercial director is really well trained to deal with studio executives and investors and producers and actors and egos and all of that stuff. That's why a lot of these young filmmakers get destroyed on their first feature because they get just run over. Whereas a commercial director, it's got a little bit more armor. It got a little couple more tools in the toolbox.
You kind of learn how to be kind of diplomatic and to kind of deal with those different personalities and try and kind of do what you want to do, but also kind of make them the client and people feel part of it as well. And I think that that's, you know, it's really important.
It is an art form to be able to make someone else, a client, feel that it's their idea so you can get the shot that you want to get.
Exactly.
It's an art form of being able to do that. And that's, I think, some of the best feature directors in history are able to maneuver in that way, especially early on in their careers, where someone like Fincher got run over in Alien, right? And he was really well done. But then he went into to Seven. He's like, if you're going to do it, I'm going to do it my way. And he's done okay. He's done okay. He's done all right for himself. Mr. Fincher's done okay. But I just wanted to hear that, how your take was on it was. Now, how did you get a movie like Limbo off the ground? Because Limbo, obviously, when the giant robot started attacking the city in your film, that obviously sold internationally much quicker. And when the superhero showed up and helped the migrants, it was fantastic.
So, and then the car chase scene as well.
The car chase scene, it's like Fast and Furious all over again. It was crazy. But in all honesty, a film like Limbo in today's marketplace, I'm fascinated in how you were able to not only put that project together. How did you get the financing for it? How did it get out to the world? So how did you just get it off the ground? Because it is a challenge. Tell everybody what the movie is about, but it is a challenging storyline, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, to briefly say what it's about, conceptually, it's about a group of asylum seekers that are sent to a remote Scottish island to wait for their asylum claims. But it really centers around Omar, who is a very talented young Syrian musician. And it's kind of him coming to terms with his circumstances of being a refugee. So it's not an easy sell. Tonally, it's the film, as well, I suppose that's kind of what made this sort of treatment of this subject matter maybe a little bit more interesting for financiers, in that it had an interesting tone because it uses comedy or it uses absurdist humor in approaching the subject matter. But getting off the ground, I have to say, I think in our case it was actually relatively straightforward because we have a really good sort of system in the UK, a structure for making films at this level and for kind of then, this kind of structure to support young filmmakers or, emerging filmmakers making their sort of first or second feature films. So in that sense, in my case, because I had the Picadero, which was my, low budget debut before Limbo, we were sort of kind of Picadero did really well in its context, so we were kind of on the radar of the industry and of that kind of core structure in the UK with the BFI and Screen Scotland, who's the sort of government, Scottish government funding body, and then we've got Film 4 and BBC Films as well, which are the two kind of main broadcaster funders. It was because of Picadero, because what Picadero had was it sort of had kind of established or started to establish kind of my sort of style and voice and vision as a filmmaker. So we got the initial funding for the screenplay from Creative Scotland. And then basically the industry were kind of ready to and kind of looking forward to reading the script because of Picadero. And fortunately they liked the script. So it came on board, and then we had a commitment to production. So yeah.
That's really awesome, because in Europe you have those kind of and in like in Australia and in a couple other places, New Zealand, they have these kind of government systems that help artists. In America, they're nothing. There's just, there's nothing for us here. Like, there's, you got to scrap it up, you know. So film like Limbo, you would have literally had to knock on dentist's door and said, hey, do you want to invest in a movie kind of thing. So that's so wonderful that you're able to have that kind of support system in the UK and in Europe in general. I know a lot of countries have it out there, but that's great, because you need to get stories like this out into the world. And it's hard to get, like, it's very hard for an American filmmaker to get this made today. I mean, unless they have a lot of cachet or a lot of, you know, festival. And even then, it's very difficult. So that's why I was fascinated. I'm like, how the hell did you get this out?
Yeah, because it's more common in the US as well to write scripts on spec, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So it's, so it's kind of like that kind of early development isn't as common there. So there's not kind of a buy-in at an early stage. It's kind of like you've got to have a finished script that's really been kind of worked on a lot.
You need a finished script. You need stars attached. You need pre-sales already set up in distribution. You need to have a P&A budget already set up and some sort of theatrical. Well, not now as much, but before you would need, like, do you have some sort of theatrical in place for a day and day and day? Like, distributors now want you to bring, literally just do all the work for them. As much as you we're just going to take 30% and not do anything. You're going to do all the hard work and we're just going to put it out for you. And that's and you have to market it as well. And if you don't have an audience, it's even tougher. So what do you do? So we're moving to Scotland, I guess, you know. I guess we're just going to deal with rainy weather.
I was thinking of making my next film in the US, but now I'm kind of starting
I think you should start it in Europe and maybe finish it out here. I don't know. Maybe cast it from here. I don't know. but now there's some scenes in the movie, the classroom scenes, which were completely absurd. they were just absurd in what was going on. Is that accurate? Is that what happens? And can you explain what happens in those kind of classroom scenes to the refugees?
They're based on reality. So, you know, I definitely kind of heighten the absurdity of those scenes in the film, but they are based on real classes that take place in different European countries, but the ones that I came across were in Norway and Finland. And, you know, I came across a class in Germany that's how to teach asylum seekers how to flirt with German girls.
so that should be a movie in itself.
They were really based on real cultural assimilation classes.
And it's always essentially just the West's way of dealing with that, like the way, I mean, because you're coming from completely different culture, and it's just, I guess, the West is trying to teach their way of doing. Is like, can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the thing that kind of goes back. It's kind of like Orientalism and kind of this idea, like the construction of the other, which is this sort of very kind of Western approach to the rest of the world. And is you know, and it's connected with British colonialism and imperialism. And it just goes back so far that there's this kind of idea that just still exists. And that's really, you know, an example of that. And, you know, with these classes in Norway, you know, obviously people are really patronized by this. It's incredibly patronizing, you know, to have these sorts of classes. And they're compulsory in Norway in order to get asylum. And so it really is kind of, very kind of inherently absurd.
It's a completely absurd, because I mean, some of these refugees might be like extremely well-educated people They just happen to be refugees. And you're like, this is how you talk to a German girl if you want to pick her up and flirt. And you're just like, it was very absurd. I love that scene. By the way, I absolutely love that you have friends in there. So there's a scene in the movie that the refugees are watching Friends, and then the later that conversation about the break was so brilliant. And that there was bootleg Friends seasons there. Yeah. And the comment was like, what was it? The comment was like, can you get, why couldn't we get a mattress? It was like, why couldn't you get a mattress? He goes, no, that's very high in demand. I got these Friends. A coat. A coat. That's what it was. I'm sorry. It was a coat. Yeah. Why didn't we get a coat? Well, it's very high demand. But Friends CDs, DVDs everywhere. And it really is like, I lived in the US all my life. And it's like, we do truly, our number one export is our culture. Is that dream. And when you see, refugees from Syria watching Friends and just like getting into it, because I don't see now, maybe a little bit more with Netflix, that you kind of see a little bit more international stuff coming into our feeds. But general Americans are just so, it's all we have no reference point outside, where the rest of the world, that's all they have is like American, that American, we were talking about the comeback story about how we were, before we weren't doing really well in the whole vaccine and the whole COVID thing. And now we're leading the world in, vaccinations. And now we're like exporting out vaccines to India. And we're like,
it's the Rocky story.
It's the Rocky Indy. It's America. That's what America's good at. We're good. But we sell that. I always say America's great at selling the sizzle, but they're not really good at selling the steak. Because the American dream sounds fantastic, but the actual American dream is very, very difficult, if not impossible for some people, depending on where you come from.
Yeah.
I don't want to get into a larger conversation about immigration, because that's a whole other podcast for another day. But I just found that very fascinating that you put that in there. And what was the why did you pick Friends? I just out of curiosity. And how did you get the rights to Friends? How did you get the rights to Friends? That's another question.
Well, that's another story. Yeah, I mean, wow. No, I mean, like in terms of Friends being written into the script, it was actually something that was just very natural to me to do, because it's something, it's a series that is. It is global. You go anywhere in the world and everyone has watched Friends. I lived in Syria and people watching Friends, they sell a lot of bootleg DVDs in Syria as well. And you just see all of the seasons, lined up outside shops and everywhere in the world. I mean, I remember being in China as well and, meeting someone that their English name was Monica because of Friends, So it's so kind of global and universal and also cross generational. That's the other really interesting thing about Friends, because I've got 16-year-old, 18-year-old cousins, and they've seen all of Friends. They're obsessed with Friends.
I have 9-year-olds. I have 9-year-olds, and the other day Jennifer Aniston happened to just come on the screen for like some show or something, and she's like, "Daddy, isn't that Rachel from Friends?" And my wife and I just look at each other like, maybe we've gone too far. Maybe we shouldn't have let them watch all those Friends episodes. Yeah. But they loved it. Yeah. They love Friends. Like, even though it's a little inappropriate sometimes,
it's still going strong.
How did you get the rights? I have to ask. How did you get the rights?
We got the rights. So yeah, it was actually, so we were told that it would be impossible, essentially.
Right.
And then Irune, who's the producer, she's also my wife, she was put in touch with someone who knew David Schwimmer, and then she got in touch with David Schwimmer. I think I wrote a letter to David Schwimmer, then Irune sent it on to him. And then he basically read the script and he loved the script, and he basically said that he wanted to help us out. And he told us that basically we could have scenes with him in it, because he could give the rights, he could help get the rights to the scenes with him in it, but we wouldn't be able to get any of the scenes of any of the other characters, right? So that was it. So we were like, great. So we'll use Ross scenes in Friends, and then basically, yeah, he was actually really instrumental. We wouldn't have been able to do it without. It was quite touch and go. I think it was actually quite difficult even for him at points to kind of get past Warner Bros. But he kind of just like fought the battle for us, and he ended up getting us the rights. So it was incredible, and then we sent him a bottle of Pacharán, which is a kind of Basque liqueur.
as you should.
Yeah, as we should. So we also we don't actually know if he's seen the film yet or not. We want him to see the film. We hope he's seen it. But
you need to send a link.
We have, but he's David Schwimmer, so like
he's
we're,
busy.
He's busy.
Yeah. I get it. That's a fascinating story because just being here in LA, I know that's impossible. Like you can't get that's why I was so shocked at a kind of like indie film from Europe.
Yeah.
Got a clip of Friends of like,
yeah.
And I'm like, how the hell did they clear that? Because I mean, the budget to clear that must be the budget of the film. Like how, because I know how difficult that is, but now that makes sense. And people listening, like when you said David Schwimmer, I'm like, and like David has no control over any of that. So like, I'm like, when you said that, I was like, he can't, like, he must've just started pulling favors. He started making phone calls and pulling people because he has the cast has no power over any of that. They're just the cast, but they have influence.
But he did it. That's amazing.
That's a great story.
And we got a good price on the rights as well, I think. So, I think David Schwimmer also got us a discount.
I can't even comprehend. Let's just put it this way. I don't think I've seen a clip of Friends anywhere else other than Friends. Like I haven't seen it in popular culture in other shows. Unless it's a Warner Brothers project, and even then, I'm sure it's even an issue. But so that's why I was so shocked. So that's a great story. So everybody knows, just contact David Schwimmer and write a really good script, write a letter, and it'll all work out at the end. One thing I found really interesting about your directing style, it is a fairly unique visual style. It kind of calls back to Wes Anderson a little bit in the way you aim the shots. In the quirky colors and the color palette you use, the wallpapers and stuff. One question I have to ask is, what lens do you use for those internal bedroom shots? Because now we're going to get into like geek film stuff. Because it's wide, but it doesn't fisheye. So it's fairly wide. So I just would love to know what that is.
Yeah. It was 16 mil.
It was a 16 mil. Was it Zeiss or Cook?
Yeah.
Cook?
16 mil Zeiss.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Standard, 16 mil Zeiss standard primes.
Standard primes, not super speeds. Standard prime?
No, they were standard primes.
They were standard. Nice.
Yeah. So actually, my first film, Picadero, we shot on super speeds, but this was with standard primes.
If you ever, sorry guys, we're going to go off on a filmmaker geek thing here. If you ever really want to like go all in on the wide, get a Canoptic 9.8.
Oh wow!
The Canoptic 9.8 is Stanley Kubrick's lens. He used for Barry Lyndon.
And fisheye, right? It's like,
So the shot in sorry guys, we're film geeking out here. So the shot in Clockwork Orange where they knock on the door right before the rape scene, and there's that wide shot that he's just crossing into the library.
That was
the Canoptic. The maze scene in The Shining. All the Canoptic, following the kid on the Canoptic. Yeah. So it's a super wide, the lens. I have one, but I have the 16 millimeter version of it, which is, what is it? I forgot the millimeter of it. It's a 5.6. So I have a 5.6 in the 16 version of it. And I connect it to my Blackmagic, my Blackmagic pocket camera, the 1080p one. Oh, it's gorgeous. Nice. I shot it on my last feature. I shot with it like that. And everyone was just like, what is going on? It's still all crystal clear. So it helps to have a lot of light with that lens. But with the 9.8 is gorgeous. So if you ever really want to kind of talk to your DP about it and just like
9.8
Canoptic. It's a specialized. Canoptic. Yeah, it's a special. They don't make it anymore. So it's a vintage. It's vintage. But if you like want to go all in. You really want to get that. It's the It's the Kubrick lens, bro. I mean, no, it's Stanley. It's a French lens, if I'm not mistaken, and they made a handful of them. But they're around. You can rent them. I mean, here in LA, they're around in LA. But even in Europe, I know they're around. So definitely check it out. Anyway, guys, I'm sorry we went on a film geek tangent here. Sorry, the gear porn. This was a little bit of a gear porn, so I apologize.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And by the way, what did you shoot this on? What camera was it? Out of curiosity, it looked great.
We shot it on Alexa.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, because it has a nice soft image to it. It's very, very, very pleasant edges. Yeah. It's not like hard. Yeah. It's not hard edge.
No. Like that's and that's the thing. I'd love to shoot on film. If I'm not, if I can't shoot on film, then for me it's got to be Alexa.
Yeah, and you shot film before, so you've shot feature. Did you shoot your last feature on feature? No.
That was also Alexa.
But you shot film on commercials.
I shot film in film school. That's the only chance that I ever had, that I've ever had to shoot film. And actually, it was 16 mil. I've never shot 35 mil film.
Oh man! I mean, you're a bit younger than me then, apparently, because
that's the thing. Yeah, I'm kind of,
I've shot when I was commercials. I shot 35, shot 16. So I have my Super 8 right next to me, and we shoot Super 8 all the time and get a transfer to 6.5K. So you can really, it's gore. Oh yeah. Film is great. And everyone listening, there's this thing about film. It's kind of like going back to the video store, nostalgia. I was like, oh man, wasn't the video store is great, but I'm not sure if I would want to go and rent a movie and go through that whole process. It's just so much more convenient to just stream it or put in a Blu-ray or something along those lines. Film has for me that kind of, unless you're Chris Nolan, you've got all the money in the world and all the resources in the world. Film's great. And if a specific film, if a specific kind of project, then film is awesome. But there's something for me, the smell of the can, the smell of the celluloid. I just went back and retransferred all my old 35 I had lying around for like 20 years to retransfer it, to rescan it at 4K. Cause I wanted to go back and like recolor grade it. And then I put it up on the monitor and I would see every little bit of dirt that went through every little, I'm like, oh my God, it looks awesome.
Nice.
So there's things that you can do on film that you just can't do in the Alexa, but 95% of the time, the image is fine. But if you ever want to play, it's awesome.
And when was the last time you shot film? Was it?
Oh, I haven't shot
film. Like since kind of digital took over, have you had the chance to go Super back
8,
to film? Or
Super 8 is the only thing I've shot. I've shot a lot of Super 8 since then, which still has that film, definitely has that film texture. And I did, getting it transferred here in LA at 6.5. So you get, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. I mean, some of the, if you shoot the proper stock, oh my God, you can get Super 8 to look gorgeous. It's really, really nice stuff. But I haven't shot 35, 25 years probably. I haven't shot. Wow. Yeah, but so I'm not sure when I would shoot it again. Like I don't know if I would shoot a feature unless it was. I just need a lot of resources.
You had Chris Nolan's budget.
I mean, yeah, you want to shoot IMAX, brother? That's great, Chris, for you, man. I love it. Yeah, JJ, you want to shoot Star Wars in great, but for the rest of us on an indie budget,
Don't
really know. And also it's hard to find a DP nowadays that can run, that knows how to shoot it on film anymore.
It's true. And the conditions as well. It depends on the film. Like if it, we shot on an actual remote Scottish island. So there was just like far too many variables. So it just would have been a nightmare. It wouldn't have worked.
Finding camera assists who know how to deal with film, how to load a film mag, how to deal with film, finding the lab. I mean, you're in Scotland, so I'm assuming the film lab is not right around the corner either. So you're going to have to ship, get it transferred, upload dailies. Like it would have been an insane process for you. Here in LA, it's even a little bit easier. But even here, it's still like there's, it's money, it's cost, it's everything. But aesthetically, man, there's things you could do with film that you just can't do digitally, aesthetically. My buddy, one of my great buddies, he was a DP on American Horror Story, which shoots completely on film. And they shot reversal. They shot black and white. They shot Super 8. They like took the film negative, threw it in a bathtub, scratched it up with sand, ran it through the scanner again because they wanted that kind of like – DP – Michael, I forgot his last name. He wanted the creator went to the DP and said, "Hey, I want this scene to look like Nazi Germany porn, a Nazi Germany porn film." And you're like, "What?" So that's what they got. And it's like, and the DP was like looking through the computer, doing research. He's like, "I hope no one is looking at my search right now, because Jesus, if someone's watching me, I get a knock on the door any minute."
CIA knocked down his door. Like,
what are you doing? Anyway, sorry for that tangent, guys. We'll get back into it. Talking about the visual style, what's your influences? Like, I mean, I'm assuming Wes Anderson had a little bit to do, or am I off kilter there? Because it has a little bit of that vibe.
Not so much. I mean, the main influences for me actually kind of go back to that time where sort of I was studying Middle Eastern cinema, and there were two that came up in quite quick succession, which were two films. One called The Time That Remains by Elia Suleiman, the Palestinian director, and another film called The Band's Visit by Aaron Colleran. And those were the two films that kind of made me want to be a film director. And they had, you know, you could relate the style of those films as well to Wes Anderson. And I suppose that there's a kind of, I wouldn't call it a movement, but sort of a group of filmmakers that have similar sensibilities that kind of root back to Yasujirō Ozu and, you know, I guess Jim Jarmusch is part of that, and Aki Kaurismäki and Roy Andersson, Swedish director. And once I kind of like started to sort of find these directors, I suppose I would like look for more that were like that. I think Fernando Mbeki, the Mexican director as well. And that kind of, I suppose, formed my sort of base of kind of influence in sort of stylistic elements. But then, I suppose since then, I kind of also, I suppose, became more influenced by, you know, people like P.T. Anderson and right. Nuribilge Ceylan, the Turkish director, and Lynn Ramsey as well. Scottish director.
What I loved about it is that it has that kind of like master shot, and you let the actors do what they need to do, and then the movements of it. But it's the framing is so beautiful. Like every shot is like a painting. Like that's a beautiful way of looking at it. It's a wonderful file, and it works really well with Limbo. Like the absurdity of some of the stuff needs to be. You don't need to cut all around. Just like let that thing sit.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, is that a lot of the humor is coming from the style of filmmaking. So it's coming from the composition. It's coming from the lens choice. You know, it's like using that wide lens on a close up creates an element of absurdity and humor in the way that it sort of lenses the faces, and using color, as you say, kind of creates that sort of playful feel. So it's actually kind of like really imbuing the film with this sort of undertone of humor, but then playing things very straight. And then that sort of allows that kind of tonal balance as well to sort of go from that humor and absurdity and then kind of pivot into the more dramatic and serious tones of the film.
Now, you had some amazing performances in your film. How do you have any advice on working with actors and getting the performances you're looking for?
I think one of the things that's really important for me is the rehearsal period and having time for that. And that's kind of not only to sort of go through the scenes and but it's you know, really to sort of spend that time exploring the characters with the actors, and kind of having those conversations where you're kind of going into depth about the characters and going into depth about the scenes, but also just building the relationship with the actors, you know, as a kind of, and ultimately that's, for me, is like, if you kind of build a relationship of sort of trust, and where you can sort of have this sort of open collaboration, then it just kind of makes everything so much easier. So, you know, I think that was one of the things that was really key in Limbo, was that, you know, we had a really good team, and I had a really good relationship with the actors. So it kind of almost, you know, felt like being on set with friends, and you're sort of building, you know, and I also, I mean, very sort of clear with kind of my vision for the film, but it's like sharing that vision, and then we're kind of working towards the same vision. So we're not kind of pulling in different directions. And even if there is questions and there's sort of a difference of opinion, that relationship is there. So we can have a very kind of, yeah, very open and normal, you know, conversation about these things. So, I think that that's kind of one, you know, kind of a major part of it, is really just like anything. It's like any kind of relationship and any working relationship is to kind of have sort of communication and trust and openness.
Do you feel that actors, I found this to be true. I'd love to hear what you think, that actors need to feel safe. They need to be in a safe environment where they can perform. If they don't feel safe, or if they don't feel that the director has their back, that is when you start getting the grind or the fight back or the pushback.
Exactly.
They become protective of themselves. Like, well, this guy or gal is not going to protect me. I'm going to protect myself because I'm on the screen. So is that fair?
No, 100%. And that's the thing, because actors are putting themselves into a very vulnerable position. And I think that's why it's kind of, yeah, that you want to create a safe environment for them to do their work, and also value them. Like, I think that's the other thing that can happen, is that kind of actors, like, sometimes can feel undervalued, and you do get sort of, you know, different directing styles, and maybe you get directors that are more comfortable dealing with the camera than dealing with the actors, for example.
Right.
But, you know, and it's like, I think that's the thing, is that the actors are so important. They are everything, you know. It's like they it's like, it doesn't, you know, it's like, so, and I think that they need, or needs maybe the wrong word, but, you know, it helps if they feel that you value them, that you value and see how important they are and how instrumental their craft is to creating a good film. You know, to create, you know, and that's it, because it is a craft. It's a skill. It's as much as, you know, a cinematographer, you know, or the other elements. And I think that often actors kind of, you know, can be treated as almost as if it's like an afterthought. It's like, okay, so we've set everything up. We've done everything. Now, okay, go and do the, you know,
dance monkey,
dance
monkey.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
deliver,
I think
the lines, you
deliver the lines the way I said it in one take and we're done. Okay. Cause you're not really that important. You're much, that vase in the background is much more important than you are. And that's when problems occur without questions. No, a lot of times, look, in our industry, especially in the indie film world, what is sold to us by the companies and by marketing is all about the gear. And the 15K and the 30K and the new lenses and the old lenses and the this and that. And, you know, what they talk about a lot of times when they talk about someone like Kubrick is what I just, like, you and I just geeked out a bit about like, oh, he used the Canoptic 9.8 and he got this shot, or what was the lens that he used for HAL in 2001? And, like, that's all cool and part of the process. But no one, and that's sexy. That's super sexy. That's like the sexy part. No one's like, we got to get into weeds and rehearse with this actor and really build a character. Like, that's not marketed as much. That's not talked about as much. And most filmmakers lack in that creation of vibrant characters with the actors as a team. And that's what jumps off on Limbo. Like, all those actors, you could just tell, are having a great time. And there's a comfortability in what they're doing. They feel very comfortable. I can see that in the screen. They're going out for it. They're going for it because they feel protected. And that's something that everyone listening really should understand, that I don't care if you're shooting with your iPhone, man. It's all about what's in front of that lens, man. And the actors are they're the tools, man. They're the things that are going to bring your story to life. Not the lens, not the camera, not the color grading, not the giant robot that's going to kill the giant lizard. Like, that's nice. That's nice. And a lot of times those movies, like, look, I'll call it out, like Godzilla versus King Kong. I loved it. It was super fun. But I'm not thinking a whole lot about it. I'm like, my wife's like, why do you want to watch it? I'm like, because I want to watch Godzilla fight King Kong for 3 or 4 scenes. Like, that's essentially what I'm watching it for. I'm not watching it for a deep plot, as long as you're going into it with that. So there's places for those kind of movies. But for this kind, I mean, filmmakers really need to really connect with that. You agree?
Yeah, no, 100%. I think that's, yeah, it really, and you know, it's also even just like, simple things make a difference as well. You know, it's like even just going up and speaking to your, going up close and having an intimate conversation with the actors on set, rather than yelling your lines to them or telling your first AD to deliver notes to your, you know, so it's like every single time go and speak to the actors, go and have that. And because that's the partnership and the teamwork that makes, you know, a good film.
No question. Yeah. The guys who sit behind in Video Village, just like, hey, I need you to say this line again. Oh, but let's put a little bit more stank on it. Like, it's like, like, what? You know, and you see the actor, I've seen it. I've been on set with directors like that. And you see the actor like, what did he say? What's going on? Yeah. And then they'll stop the whole thing and you can start seeing the frustration. And that's when the whole thing starts coming crashing down, man. Now, your film has been nominated for a couple of BAFTA awards, man. So I have to ask you, I'm assuming these are your first awards nominations. How did that feel? Because that's essentially, for everyone listening, the BAFTA is the Oscars of Great Britain. So how did that feel?
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, you know, I have to say, like, you know, it's incredible because it's something that you sort of dream of, and like, you know, when you start making films and you kind of dream of getting BAFTA nominations and that kind of thing. But at the same time, you know, it's been such a weird year with the pandemic. So it's almost like there's part of it that kind of doesn't feel real because, you know, in a normal world, the ceremony, you know, it's like the Oscars. There's a huge ceremony. It's at the Royal Albert Hall. Like, it's, the big red carpet and the after party and like all of these things, a big meal beforehand. None of that happened, you know? So it's like, it's getting the nominations and then we're just kind of on Zoom, like, you know, watching the ceremony and then it kind of like dressed up at home and and then it kind of passes and I think that it's been a kind of a year of that a little bit in general, because, you know, the first sort of bit, like, big bit of success that we got was when we got the Cannes selection, and that was, you know, cancelled, and so we just kind of got the Cannes label, and then since then it's just like that with every, you know, it's like we got into Toronto for the premiere, but we weren't in Toronto, we couldn't travel to Toronto, you know, again, it's like a big deal to, you know, have the film premiering there, but it, you know, so by the time the BAFTAs came around, it's just this very odd thing where you sort of, obviously it's amazing and you kind of really value that, but at the same time, yeah, it's kind of bittersweet and you don't, it doesn't feel fully real. I don't know if ever will, or if they'll invite us next year, you know, when they have the actual ceremony, or I don't know, you know, it's kind of,
it's a weird time for everybody. I mean, I know people who won, you know, that are winning the Oscars that just happened a little while ago.
Yeah,
like, they just like you don't really, it's not the thing. Like, I know filmmakers who got into South by Southwest, which is a huge deal, and then they canceled it. And you're just like, what? I've been waiting all my life to get into this, and they canceled it. I mean, we get the moniker, we get the but we can't fly there, we can't really screen there, the distributors aren't going to be looking there, all that kind of stuff. It's pretty mind-blowing, honestly. It's pretty mind-blowing. But look, you still got accepted into Cannes. You still got accepted into Toronto. You got some BAFTA awards. When everyone 20 years from now looks back, that's all they'll see. They won't know that you didn't go.
I won't have the memories, but I'll have it on my IMDb page.
You'll have it on, and really, truly, that's really all that matters. Not life experiences. It's all about the credits and the awards on the IMDb page. That's really all that matters. Now, I wanted to ask you, what do you hope that this film does in the world? Because it is touching and talking about a very serious issue. I feel, you know, about refugees coming in into other countries. It's happening in our country very famously, you know, happening now in our country, and it's happening all over the world. But I feel that it's only going to get worse. I feel that with global warming and environmental things, there's going to be millions, if not possibly billions, of refugees in hopefully many years away from us as possible. But look, things are getting crazy. So what do you hope that this film does as far as putting a spotlight on that issue?
I mean, one of the reasons that I was sort of kind of drawn to making a film about this subject matter was that, you know, I was really struck by kind of what I found was a sort of process of dehumanization that we were kind of experiencing of refugees. And that was sort of through the media or, you know, different kind of depictions where you had this kind of, the refugees, you know, refugees were treated as kind of numbers and statistics, and you had kind of demonizing on the right-wing media, and you had the pitying of refugees as well. And both of these things were dehumanizing. And so what I kind of really want from this film, it's you know, obviously you have a whole lot of creative desires as a filmmaker and the things that you kind of want to achieve, because in the end, you know, you're making a film. It's something that's creative and that's has my voice behind it as a filmmaker. But it is also to spotlight this issue. And I think that, you know, it is a different kind of way of looking at this subject matter, and it's a sort of different access point. And really kind of what I would like is for, you know, people to go to the cinema or, you know, wherever they watch the film and spend an hour and 40 minutes with these people on screen and look up to these people on screen, to these characters on screen, and feel close to them and feel like you know them and that you find parts of yourself in them. And then come away from the film and carry these characters around in you for a while afterwards. And I think, yeah, that's what I would like, because, you know, in general, it's otherwise, you know, refugees are just kind of, yeah, numbers, statistics, that, you know, it's kind of sensationalized snapshots. But they're real people that are just people. They're just human beings like us that we can relate to. And hopefully people kind of take that away from the film.
That's amazing. Well, I'm so glad that you were able to put this film out into the world in the way you did it, with a little humor to, you know, put, you know, a little honey, as opposed to vinegar on the film, maybe make it go down a little bit smoother. Now I'm going to ask you a couple questions. Ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Good question. Wow. Good question. You know, I think that, I'll kind of speak specifically about being a writer, director. And I think that one of, it's not, you know, it's not a sort of great, sort of, maybe it's not the most hopeful answer. but what I always say is that basically you just have, like, you have to just write. You have to write the screenplay. And there's so many ways to procrastinate and so many ways to kind of, like, go on these sort of endless meetings of kind of promises and sort of hope and kind of labs and, you know, script labs and all of these things. And I think that it gets to a point where all of this is kind of just like peripheral sort of just other ways to procrastinate, that in the end, if you have something inside of you where you want to write a screenplay and you want to make a film, really all you can do is write the screenplay. You've got to put yourself in the chair, sit down and put the hours in and that's it. Spend the time in the saddle and write the screenplay. And that, and unfortunately, like, that really is the answer. That's the first thing that you can do to break into the film. If you want to be a writer director, is just write the screenplay. That's it. There is no other. That's all. You need the product.
Write as much of it as you can. As much as you can. As many as you can.
And it's painful. That's the other thing as well. It's not easy. So when it gets really hard and you want to give up on the screenplay, it's meant to feel like that. It's meant to be really difficult. You don't get anything for free. That's the thing. It's you know, to work in the film industry is and kind of make money from making films, it's a very privileged position to be in. So you don't get that for free. It's a lot of, you know, hard work and a lot of hours. And in the end, you kind of just got to put the time in, and it's going to be difficult and it's going to be painful and you're going to want to give up, and you just kind of have to sort of push through it and keep going and keep going.
So you obviously are not going to be the marketing wing of the filmmaking dream, obviously. So this is not the way we pitch the deal. It's horrible branding. What it is all you got to do is just show up to Hollywood and things, they just give you money. That's what's been sold to us here in the States for the longest time, and it seems to be working out. truer words have never been said, sir, in regards to our process and what we do. And it is a very, very difficult process, and that's what I try to do with this show, is to let everybody know. Like I always tell people, you're going to get, no matter who you are, no matter how big you are, what stage in the career you are at, you could be Steven Spielberg, you could be that film student, you're going to get punched in the face. You're going to get punched in the face in one way, shape, or form. Something's going to happen. You're going to get punched in the face. The problem is that most filmmakers don't even know that there's punches involved. And when they get the first one, they're out. And they're knocked out cold, and they don't come back out after it. So I'm trying to prepare them to let them know, look, you're going to get punched. Now learn how to take the punch and keep going forward. Keep taking the punches and keep going forward. And then eventually, when you get a little older, you learn how to duck a little bit. You learn how to weave. And occasionally you'll learn not to even be where the punch is being thrown at all. You're not even in the same room. So occasionally you'll do that, but no matter who you are, you're going to get punched. So that's great. Great advice.
Pretty good.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Oh, I think that, you know, the lesson that I'm still learning is how to switch off. that's the lesson that I really want to learn, like how to kind of how to switch off, how to relax, you know, how to kind of that's difficult. I'm still trying to figure that out.
Well, it's a disease. I mean, we're inflicted with a disease. It's called filmmaking. It's like, it's once you get the bug, you can't get rid of it. It can go dormant for decades, but it always comes back. It's like this craziness. I still remember talking to filmmakers when the pandemic hit. First things that go through their mind, I'm like, how are we going to shoot a movie? I'm like, dude, the world is coming to an end, and you're talking about shooting a movie. This is the insanity of filmmakers. Like, that's how we think. It took me a long time, by the way, to learn that lesson. To be able to shut it off. It was my wife to help me with that. Because if it was me, I would have been on, and I was, 18 hours a day. All day, every day, working on something, online, working. It was just like this obsession that just kept going.
Yeah. And then when you're not working, it's like putting the pressure on yourself, like feeling that you should be working or that you can be doing more, if you're not kind of breaking through with your screenplay or whatever, like that. You then, you know, you're putting that pressure on yourself, and you're feeling, you know, so it's that's a kind of, that I'm still kind of figuring that out, like how to do that. I think video games help.
You're talking like an addict. Did you hear the words that are coming out of your mouth? You sound like an addict. You're like, you know, when I get the itches, when I get this, I gotta, you know, video games help. That term is like, that means there's a problem. Like, it's so wonderful. It's like, you know, occasionally walks. I do a walk every once in a while just to kind of, you know, it's like, it's so funny, but it is an affliction that we have been blessed and cursed with all at the same time. And I know that feeling that you're talking about, where you're like, I should be writing something. I should be watching a movie and analyzing it. I should be, I should be figuring out, I should be making a phone call. I should be trying to do something. I should be trying to get a project off the ground. That kind of energy is something that happens, especially when you haven't broken through, especially when you're still, you're still hustling and trying to get your career off the ground. It is an affliction. It really is. I found the, finally found the way to chillax about that to a point where now I'm just very mellow about it. And that's also age, dude. It's just age. It's just, it's just time, man. As you get older, you just start figuring out things that are more important in your life and things that interested you in your 20s and 30s. When you get in your 40s, you get family. Things just start to shift a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
So if you're in your 20s, enjoy it because it goes quick. It goes quick. It goes quick. And last question, three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, three of all time. Oh. Wow, I hate these questions.
three that come to mind right now.
You know, okay, so I'm gonna say those two films that I said earlier on because those were the two films that kind of made me want to make films. So The Time That Remains by Elia Suleiman and The Band's Visit by Erin Colleran. And then I'm gonna say, what am I gonna say? I'm not gonna say Grace for all, but I'm gonna say the film, like a film that I kind of go back to. It's actually probably the first screenplay that I ever read. It's actually Good Will Hunting.
Yeah, I love Good Will Hunting, man. I'm going to say that.
Yeah, it was the first script that I read that I kind of like saw the film and I was like, I'm going to read the script. I think when I was just kind of like.
Did you buy the book? Yeah, because it was selling the script. They sell the book script. They had Pulp Fiction as well. So they had Pulp Fiction's book as well. There was a handful of those back in the 90s that you could buy them like that. Yeah. Nice. That was a good script. That was a great script. That scene with Robin Williams on the bench. Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's just he won the Oscar in that scene.
So the one with Minnie Driver as well.
That brings
me to tears every time. Like really. Oh, I'm a crier. I cry at films all the time. I don't know, and the ending,
like I gotta go see about a girl. Like, oh, it's just like so brilliant, so well put together. But Ben, man, thank you so much for being on the show, bro. It has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you again so much for making Limbo and putting it out into the world. And I hope it changes the conversation a bit. I hope it changes people's perception a little bit about that problem with refugees. And it's a problem that's not going to go away anytime in the near future. So hopefully you've done some good in the world as a filmmaker. So thank you, my friend.
Thank you. Pleasure talking to you. Thanks for having me.
I want to thank Ben for coming on the show. Thank you so much, Ben. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/466. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.